Welcome to Our House, the only complete on-air resource for your home ownership needs.
Welcome to Our House. This is Susan Ballard sitting in for Peter Hunt. The show is brought to you by HuntRealEstate.com, where everything is easier for your home real estate and home ownership experience. HuntRealEstate.com is powered by Hunt Real Estate ERA in Buffalo, Niagara, Rochester, Syracuse, Greater Albany, Utica, Watertown, and Phoenix, Arizona. This show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage. Call Hunt Mortgage today at 633-3700 and ask one of our skilled mortgage consultants to work with you to find the lowest rates and closing costs for your particular home financing needs. Also ask about our many exclusive programs, including our pre-purchase commitment that allows you at no cost or risk to effectively enter the market to find your next home with cash. Call Hunt Mortgage at 633-3700 for personalized, customized service that will knock your socks off. Check out our new low-rate guarantee. Certain restrictions apply, and details are on our website at www.huntmortgage.com. And don't forget the first ever 24/7, 365 real estate hotline, the Hunt Hotline, which gives you access to all available information about any property listed for sale in Buffalo, Niagara, Rochester, Syracuse, Albany, Utica, Watertown, and even Phoenix, Arizona. Simply dial 716-631-4800 and enter the street number of the house you want to know about. No matter whose listing it is, the hotline will prompt you with a choice of street names. Select the one you want, you'll hear a brief description, and then you'll be able to be texted a link to a dedicated website on that property. All automatically and just that fast. Anytime, in any market we serve, on any listing, whether it's ours or any other broker's. There's a shortage of homes available for sale in many Western New York neighborhoods and a very high number of well-qualified buyers actively looking for a new home. If you or anyone you know have been considering selling a property, now is the time. At Hunt, you can list your home for free. That's right. At Hunt, any agent can work with you to aggressively market your home for sale to every potential buyer with no out-of-pocket cost expense to you. As a seller, you will pay a commission only if Hunt is successful in finding a buyer who is ready, willing, and able to purchase your home under the terms and conditions acceptable to you. In addition, only through Hunt, an agent, you will hear these words: "We will sell your home or ERA will buy it." That's the seller security plan. Ask about how it can work for you by calling 633-9400 or stopping into one of our many open houses this weekend. Hunt is the official real estate and relocation provider of our hometown professional teams, the Buffalo Bills, the Buffalo Sabres, and Rochester Americans. Our house is broadcast live on WBEN 930 AM. For those of you who'd like to participate in today's show, if you have any questions or comments about any aspect of real estate, call us in the studio at 803-0930, 1-800-616-9236, or star 930. Those are all free calls, so join us on the air at Our House. We have a very special show for you today, following up on a topic that came up on last week's show. Today we'll be talking about new home construction and the impact on the cost of those new homes due to regulations that have been imposed on the industry. My guest today to help us understand these issues better is Bill Tine. Bill is the Vice President of Development and Diversification at Forbes Capretto Custom Homes. He is also the current National Vice President, National Area 2 Chairman for the National Association of Home Builders, where in addition to serving on the Executive Board, he is a member of the Land Development and Legal Action Committees. He's the immediate past president of the New York State Builders Association, and he's also the past president of the Buffalo Niagara Builders Association. In 2014, he was appointed by Governor Andrew Cuomo as the building industry's representative on the New York State Fire Prevention and Building Codes Council. He is an Amherst Industrial Development Agency board member, and he is a current member of the Village of Williamsville Zoning Board of Appeals. Welcome, Bill, and thank you for joining me here today.
Good morning, Susan. I'm happy to be here.
Well, clearly from your bio, you are a resident expert in land use, and we're fortunate to have you here today. Perhaps to get started, you could just tell me a little bit about your thoughts on the current real estate market as it relates to new construction in Western New York.
I think it's a great time to build a new home. Right now, interest rates are still pretty low, and the market's pretty strong. It's great availability out there, and we'd love to build anyone a home that's interested.
That's terrific. You mentioned mortgage rates that are low. People are nervous because we keep hearing about rates creeping up, but it's not too long ago when we were contending with 7 and 8% rates, and we thought those were wonderful rates compared to years past. So I think we're fortunate that we still remain in a low rate environment, which allows the residents of Western New York to be able to purchase a home invest in the home for long term. Most mortgages people are looking at are 15 and 30 year mortgages. They're planning to stay in their homes for a long time. So with rates as low as they are right now, it really does seem to be a good time to buy and to invest in the real estate.
I agree, and there's great value in Western New York.
Absolutely. Now, you have obviously been involved with construction at a number of levels. Prior to your role at Forbes Capretto, where you're the vice president of development and diversification, you had a career in land use planning?
Land use consulting, absolutely. I was with a local consulting firm, Pratt & Huth Associates, here for 20 years. And then after that, we sold the business to a national firm, Greenman Peterson, where I was the vice president and director of town planning for that company.
So clearly you have been on the industry side of things, but also as a member of the Industrial Development Agency in Amherst and on the Zoning Board of Appeals in the Village of Williamsville, you've been on the municipal side of things as well, representing perhaps a industry perspective on those boards. What we wanted to talk about today, and I think you're the perfect guest to help educate us, relative to regulations that have come into play in the construction industry and how it relates to the cost of new construction. What we've seen is a separation in the cost of existing homes and new homes. New homes have typically been a little bit more expensive than existing homes because they have new technologies and raw materials increase and labor increases. But it seems like there's been a dramatic separation in terms of the escalation of costs for new construction relative to the increasing costs or the value of existing homes. Can you sort of help us understand why there's been that sharp increase in costs?
Well, there's been an increase in the number of regulations that have been promulgated that have really impacted the business from the land development side and the construction side. Has to do with increases in regulation, which, and I don't think we want to represent that all regulation is bad. There's a purpose to the regulations, and ideally those are things that make homes and communities safer, make infrastructure ideally things that are going to last longer and have lower maintenance over time, that result in homes that have better energy efficiency and better payback and return to folks with new homes. So there's a lot of issues that are good that come out of regulation, but there's also the downside, and that comes in the form of increased cost, and that is environmental regulation. It has to do with building codes and the evolution of the design standards and materials. There's a whole gamut of issues that really affect the cost and pricing of homes, from the land development side all the way through the construction of the home. And it's actually probably felt strongest at the development side of things, bringing lots to market so there are sites where people can build a home.
So you're talking about taking raw land and developing it to the extent where you can put in utilities and roads. That's what you mean by development.
Correct. You take a piece of land that is what's unimproved, sort of like a monopoly board. When you go around the board and you land on the parcel, when your thimble lands on Baltic Place, it's just a square. But if you come around, you can then invest and add more and more to it. And that's the first step of that, the foundation, if you will, of the development process is getting the site approved by making sure it has water, sewer, drainage facilities, electricity, natural gas, a street, all of these kind of elements that we call infrastructure that enables that home to stand and function.
It's interesting that you chose the analogy of the Monopoly board, mm-hmm. Because I think it's a great visualization, because we all remember playing the game and, as you say, landing on a particular property. And the key was you had to invest. You had to take money out of your stash, even though it was play paper money. Mm-hmm. You have to invest. And in order to do that, in the real world, it's become increasingly more expensive. And it seems to me that there are fewer developers out there that are putting in neighborhoods and communities. And I know there are limitations relative to the infrastructure that we have in place, whether it be roadways or utilities or sewers. But the key investment, I think, is what I wanted to focus on a little bit today here, because obviously you said there are some regulations that are for the community good and benefits everyone, and no one would argue that some improvements in planning have taken place. But I imagine that there are a number of perhaps unintended consequences. I don't think legislators sit down and come up with something that's going to be bad for the economy and bad for the public. I think everything is entered into with the hopes that it's going to benefit everyone, but these unintended consequences that perhaps don't provide the benefit that the public needs, and they are at an increased cost that perhaps discourages reasonable development in the area. So we have a smaller supply, a greater demand, and that's part of what's driving up costs as well.
That's part of it. I don't think there's any question of that, and I think that's a very good way to frame it. It is also, there's a cost associated with delay. And so to navigate this process, which is exceedingly complex, I mean, I think most of your listeners could attend a town board meeting or a municipal board meeting, if you will, in any of their towns, villages, or cities across the area, and they will very often hear the refrain at one of the board meetings about uncontrolled development. And I can tell you from where I sit, nothing could be further from the truth. It is an extraordinarily controlled process, and it takes a very, very long time to navigate. And when you put it in the frame, when you frame the discussion in the form of an investment, recognize that when anyone wants to make an investment, you do it with hopefully with some knowledge, so that you are trying on some level to contain your risk, because an investment is risky. There is no guarantee just because you've developed a piece of property that you're going to profit off of it. You still have to be able to build something and sell it, and then hopefully sell it at a price that makes a profit. And as you're trying to forecast what the market conditions are and where you want to make that investment, and you're making it based on land use codes that have been put in place in the various communities that ordain what is to be built where, then after you go and begin to undertake this process by putting in place and building and constructing what the community has ordained, you sort of have an expectation that they've approved a plan and they expect you to build it. They want you to come and build that plan, and that the process should be relatively quick to get through. The truth is it can take, in some instances, over 10 years to get through. And I would submit that no one has a crystal ball good enough to forecast 10 years into the future to know what market conditions are like, to make that a sensible risk investment. It's a very dangerous proposition, quite frankly.
It sounds as it would be, and it seems to me that as the years progress, things tend to move faster. The economy changes faster. So if someone had planned for what was going to be happening in Western New York in 2017, 10 years ago, we probably would have missed the mark.
Mm-hmm.
And last week, when Peter Hunt and I were talking about new construction, one of Peter's concerns is whether or not we as an industry, a real estate industry, are meeting the needs of the residents of the area. Are we supplying to them the types of housing that they're looking for in the locations that they're looking for? And we would make the argument that a lot of people in Western New York are living in the wrong house. They're living in a home that if they had other options available to them, they would readily choose them. Some of it is cost prohibitive, some of it is location prohibitive, but this idea that we are not meeting the needs of the community, I think, is a shared responsibility. So we talked a little bit last week about how do you get the groups together? How do you get the municipalities, the residents, the builders, the developers, everybody on the same page for planning purposes? And it sounds like the documents that are created at the municipal level are somewhat limiting. If they put a master plan together and it's forecasting out what the outlook should be 10, 15 years from now, and the zoning guidelines stick to that plan, it doesn't sound like there's a lot of room for flexibility and adaptation if the market conditions change or if the demand from the public changes.
Well, there is. The process is designed to allow for some flexibility. And, I have to be a little careful because I can get, a bit wonkish and pretty deep in the weeds on this, because a lot of this is fairly complex on how it actually functions. But the first part of this process, if you will, on comprehensive planning is that communities put in place their own land use plan on what they want their community look like. And that document is typically designed to last for 20 years. And it's not an accident that it's a 20-year process. 20 years is the term of a generation. So we design plans for our generation's term of stewardship. And then after that, the next step is to put in place a set of zoning codes that are the regulating documents of how those land uses that are ordained and or proscribed, I should say, in the land use plan, in the comprehensive plan, this is how you actually build them. Here's the standards of how to site things and what we want to see built and constructed. And then after you get to the point where you're at building codes, now they dictate how you actually construct the home, if you will. And I would say, and of all the things you talked about in terms of diversity of housing needs, another part of that is that people's needs change over the course of their lives. So it's not a uniform process when you're coming out of when you're a child, you know, you're living in your parents' home, you have one set of housing needs where you're being taken care of. Then when you're a young adult coming out of college, you may have a very different type of housing need. And then as you begin to raise a family, there's another one. And then when you enter into retirement, there is another one again. So there's this constant, it's not, the world's a very dynamic place, and so are our lives, and so to our housing needs.
It's interesting because in Western New York, I think we are typically considered to be a little bit more conservative, and we don't move at a rapid pace. So perhaps that's part of the reason why we don't necessarily meet the changing demands, or we don't stay as current with the demands of the public. But in terms of planning purposes and trying to put together blueprints for the town to follow in these master plans, I would imagine that there's some responsibility from the builder community and the planning community to participate in those discussions. Do you find that there's a welcome seat at the table for them?
Absolutely. I think I have never seen a community do a comprehensive plan, undertake that process without including stakeholder groups. And they typically do a very good job in putting together public hearings, inviting in existing residents and business leaders and government officials and builders and developers. Everyone has a seat at the table. So I've never seen that part of the process be left out. And then I should talk a little bit about you talked about the static nature or the inflexibility of these plans potentially. The reality is that there's a process also prescribed in law on how to rezone things. So once you go through comprehensive planning and then ultimately zoning, there is a process. If you have a different idea of what you should do with your land, you can petition and request to change the land use and the zoning for your land. And if you can make a good enough case to show that it's in the community's interest, you can make that happen. Likewise, when it comes to the codes to build things, to site them and to build them, there's a process to appear before what's called a zoning board of appeals and get an appeal from the codes in the communities to do something different. Again, if you can show that there's a hardship and that you've got a better way of doing things that will benefit the rest of the community, and you can get those things approved. So those processes are in place. The challenge, I think, is when the comprehensive planning process is done, there is a lot of regulation that covers the development process. And when a private developer undertakes the process to develop a piece of land, they have to go. The first step is something called seeker. And this is where, again, I have to be a little bit careful about getting too wonkish. But at some level, I think I can explain it. But cut me off if I go too far, I guess. The state has a law called the State Environmental Quality Review Act, which is commonly referred to as seeker. And so whenever someone does anything in government, whether government, it's actually itemized in the law, it says anything that is directly undertaken or that is funded or requires discretionary approval of some level of government has to go through the seeker process. And so that's the part where you see if someone's doing a development, that's where they're doing wetland delineations and traffic studies and sewer analyses and archaeological surveys and all kinds of things along with the survey process, the data gathering part of doing a project, and then you're supposed to analyze the social, economic, and environmental needs of the project or what will result or the impacts that will result from that project and weigh and balance them to determine what's in the community benefit. And because of the way that's written, that it's required of any seekers required of anything that is either discretionary, has discretionary approval, which is why developers have to do it, or that is directly undertaken or funded by government, government has to do it too, and they have to do it on their comprehensive plan. And so that's the part where I think, from my perspective, and it's my opinion, that very often government takes a bit of a shortcut when they do that process. So they don't make sure their comprehensive plan is actually, in fact, buildable. They leave that to the developer to figure out whether or not the land use pattern that they've approved can actually be done. And that's putting cost and delay into the development side of things that adds tremendous cost and a great deal of risk.
When you outlined all of the steps that are necessary in order to go through the evaluation of that seeker process, that's where the cost and the time lies. So the list seemed like it was fairly exhaustive.
It's a big part, but I didn't even come close to giving you the complete list.
Well, we only have an hour, so I can understand we had to keep that short. Some of it is going to be basic. Some of it should be required for all projects. But I think we're going to be breaking soon. But I think what we'd like to talk about are maybe some of the things that are a little bit excessive or perhaps unnecessary or burdensome to the communities for the regulations that are in place and that might be, at this point in time, limiting some of the opportunities for growth and development. Obviously, we want to do it in a smart and planned manner. But we also want to make sure that the supply is available to meet the needs of the community. So when we come back from break, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. We're going to be going to break, but if anyone is interested in weighing in on this subject or has questions specifically for Bill today, you can call us here in the studio at 803-0930. You can call us toll-free at 800-616-9236 or on a cell phone *930. We'll be right back with more from Our House to Yours after these messages.
If you're a homeowner age 62 or older, you owe it to yourself to look into a reverse mortgage. Reverse mortgages give seniors many different options to access the equity in their home. There's even a reverse mortgage for purchase available. For more information, call Karen Johnson, a reverse mortgage specialist at Hunt Mortgage at 633-3700 or visit huntmortgage.com. Karen Johnson, NMLS number 485939. Hunt Mortgage is a licensed mortgage banker, New York Department of Financial Services, and an equal opportunity lender.
Welcome back to Our House. This is Susan Ballard, sitting in for Peter Hunt. Our House is brought to you by HuntRealEstate.com, where everything is easier for your home ownership experience. HuntRealEstate.com is the only place on the web for a complete inventory of homes available in Buffalo, Niagara, Rochester, and Syracuse markets. You'll also find access to a complete set of home ownership services at HuntRealEstate.com. HuntRealEstate.com is powered by Hunt Real Estate ERA in Buffalo, Niagara, Rochester, Syracuse, Utica, Watertown, and Phoenix, Arizona. This show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage. For more information about our exclusive mortgage program that allows you to roll the cost of home improvements into your mortgage, allowing you to buy the before and live the after, call 633-3700 and ask for details. Ask about our pre-purchase commitment available only at Hunt Mortgage. Call today 633-3700 or call our Hunt ERA Customer Service Center at 716-633-9400, and one of our customer service representatives can instantly direct you to the appropriate professional for your particular needs, buying or selling a home, financing, insurance, or even home improvements. Remember, our guarantee stands. We will sell your home or ERA will buy it. That's the seller security plan available only through a Hunt Real Estate ERA agent. I'm in the studio today with Bill Tine, and we were discussing new construction and the cost of new construction as it relates to some of the regulations that have been imposed on the industry over, I guess, about the last 15, 20 years is when we've really seen the increased burden of costs due to regulations. And maybe you can help us to understand how that affects the cost of a new home. Let's say in Lancaster, a home today versus a home maybe 15, 20 years ago. Is it in fact the case where homeowners are spending more and perhaps getting less home because they're paying more for the cost of having developed that land in the community?
Well, I think the industry tries to make sure they're not getting less home, but they are getting a more expensive home, and so the costs are passed on. And when budgets of concern, it may mean that people are building making choices where they may have in the past built more home for themselves personally because their budget is limited, they can afford less home. So it's not that we're not offering homes that are more expensive. It's just that everyone can't reach it. And because the percentage of what that cost is going against the cost of the home, the regulatory cost is increasing, then more and more of it is going to that and to that aspect of it and impacting what they get and what they're able to afford. So I think what you see is that, again, and cost is an interesting question because it's one of cost-benefit. And that's, you know, part of the analysis that's notably lacking when regulations are promulgated is the benefit aspect of it. The cost is we see all the time, but what's the benefit and is it worth it, some of these regulations? So, and I don't know that we always think that's the case. So we have, I think we're seeing now that the regulatory cost on the price of a new home is at around 24%. Nationally is what we're seeing from studies, the burden. And that has been fairly constant over the last certainly several years. The analysis is usually done on a, I'm not sure what the actual interval is that studies are conducted, but the data is being tracked continuously. And then studies are released sometimes on an annual basis to see, you know, sometimes biannually to see what those impacts are. And we are seeing them stay, you know, a few years ago it was 25%. This year it's 24%. I've seen that a few years back where it was 27%. So it fluctuates, but it's a very high percentage. And, of course, with the consumer price index and the cost of materials, housing is becoming more expensive anyway. So that 25% gets to be more and more and more all the time.
Sure, it becomes a larger number. So when you say 25% or 24%, 27%, you're talking about the overall cost of a new home.
Correct.
Almost a quarter, or relatively a quarter of that, is related to the cost of
regulations
alone. Mm-hmm. So not the raw land and
Correct. Not
the construction of the home or anything related to that, but simply the added effect of regulations that have been put in place.
Yes.
And I think we'd agree some of those are necessary. Mm-hmm. I guess the question mark comes into play is how much of that 25% is either unintended consequences or excessive regulation or interpretation of wetlands and other gray areas or green areas. I guess we can get into a conversation relative to that. So we do have a caller who has called in with a question about development. We have Warren from Wheatfield joining us.
Hello.
Hi, Warren. I understand you have a question about development.
Yes, I do.
What can we help you with this morning? What can we help you with this morning, Warren?
Pardon me?
It sounds like Warren might be having a little trouble hearing us. Warren, you're on the air, and we understand you have a question about development.
Yes, I do.
What can we help you with?
My question is, I live on one of the old main roads in Wheatfield, and there's about five developments off my road now, and about every 5 years, I get a new development. The last one's 14 houses. I got them with 30. And I live north of these developments. And if you get a house with three cars in them, you know, every three cars, those, maybe two-thirds of those cars go by my house every day for school, for work, or whatever. Plus, they're pets. They don't want the pets going on their yuppie lawns, so they walk them past the old houses. All right? They empty their ashtrays, play their boom boxes, but they don't do it in their yuppie developments. What are your comments on that?
Well, thank you for that call, Warren. I think certainly proper manners and behavior should be expected of everyone, whether it's in a new community or whether it's in a existing community. So I certainly wouldn't condone bad behavior. But I do think that we as public citizens have a responsibility to accept growth and development. We know that the population is increasing, and people have a desire to live in communities where, you know, I might have been the first one in the neighborhood, and I enjoyed the exclusivity of being in the neighborhood. But I recognize that I have a responsibility to share the resources in the community. I know, Bill, we've had conversations over the years about you know, how you go about developing property with taking into consideration respect for the neighbors in the existing area. And maybe you can speak to some of the concerns and how those are studied and measured and hopefully mitigated.
Well, you know, we touched on it in the last segment when we were talking about comprehensive planning and what the town's, you know, vision is for itself. And that's really exactly what we're talking about here. The world is not static, and so we're planning for what we want our communities to look like for the next 20 years. And you may have folks that live on the old rural pieces that are farmland, and it's the town's I don't know, I'd say it's responsibility, but it's the town's goal is to decide for itself what it wants to be. It's not the developers that tell the town what the town should look like. The towns themselves decide what they want to look like. And when they put those plans in place, they make a decision on whether or not they want to stay rural or not. If they wanted to zone it all for agriculture, they can do that. There's nothing to stop them from saying, we're going to map our entire town as farms and we're going to keep it that way. But one of the things that happens is they don't do that. They say, we want to put in a place where there's subdivisions are allowed, single family, detached residential. We'll have another area where we want to see multifamily, another place where we want to see retail, places where we want to see schools, places where we want to see places of employment. All of those things are detailed out on the map because really communities are places where we need to live, work, and play. And all of those things go together. So if a community wants to have stores, stores need customers. And if they're going to have customers, they need to have neighborhoods. And so those neighborhoods are put on the map and people decide where they want them. That's followed by the construction of infrastructure. So you can't just put housing somewhere. You have to have sewers and treatment facilities so that the people who live there, who are going to use water and who are going to have water that needs to be treated, those facilities are constructed and built. And once they're in place, there's been a tremendous public investment in those infrastructure needs, which are really the foundation of the community. And that's how government gets paid back, is by seeing things built, assessing it, and taxing it to pay for the construction of it and then pay for the ongoing operation and maintenance of it. That includes roads and everything else. So it is a fairly complex process, and the world does change.
It's interesting that you bring up that point, because there is an awesome responsibility that's placed on the shoulders of the community leaders, the town boards, the councils, the planning boards, zoning boards. The individuals who are residents of those communities have the responsibility for laying out the plan for the individual towns. I know there's been conversation about kind of a regional approach to looking at what's best for the overall area, not the individual towns. But each town has its own requirement. Last week we had, I had the opportunity to hear from some local board members from one of the local municipalities who had listened to the program and had some very keen insights into their roles and responsibilities in making decisions about land use. Getting back to, we just have another minute or so before we go to break, but getting back to the cost, when you said before, you know, roughly 25% of the cost is related to regulation, new houses have become more and more expensive. We recognize that. I think getting into a new house today is probably a proposition where people, if it's a typical single-family home, are looking at maybe an investment of $250,000, $250,000. Is that a kind of the sort of entry level for new construction these days?
Yeah, I think that's probably a pretty fair assessment.
So 25% of that is a really staggering number. Mm-hmm. If we looked at how we break down that into necessary regulations and perhaps maybe overburden some regulations, do you have any indication of maybe what percentage of that 25% lands in each of those categories?
necessary and not necessary.
Right. Well, I mean, in terms of just opinion, I'm just curious. I mean, obviously, some of it is really required as we advance our technologies and our building improvements. But we're going to go to break now. So when we come back, we can maybe talk about that. And I think we'll have a caller when we return from break. So we'll be right back with more from Our House to Yours after these messages.
This is Linda Malaya, president of Hunt Mortgage. Hunt Mortgage is excited to offer the Pre-Purchase Commitment Program, an exclusive program that has no cost or obligation. Hunt will issue a complete mortgage commitment before you buy. Your offer will be virtually a done deal and allow it to stand out. Hunt Mortgage is a name buyers, sellers, and realtors trust. Simply go to huntmortgage.com and use our convenient online application or call any Hunt office.
Hunt Mortgage is a licensed mortgage banker, New York Department of Financial Services, and an equal opportunity lender.
Welcome back to Our House. This is Susan Ballard sitting in for Peter Hunt. Our House is brought to you by huntrealestate.com, where everything is easier for your home ownership experience. Huntrealestate.com is the only place on the web for a complete inventory of homes available in Buffalo, Niagara, Rochester, and Syracuse markets. You'll also find access to a complete set of home ownership services at huntrealestate.com. Huntrealestate.com is powered by Hunt Real Estate ERA in Buffalo, Niagara, Rochester, Syracuse, Utica, Watertown, and Phoenix, Arizona. This show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage. For more information about our exclusive mortgage program that allows you to roll the cost of home improvements into your mortgage, allowing you to buy the before and live the after, call 633-3700 and ask for details. Ask about our pre-purchase commitment available only at Hunt Mortgage. Call 633-3700 today or call our Hunt ERA Customer Service Center at 716-633-9400. One of our customer service representatives can instantly direct you to the appropriate professional for your particular needs, whether you're buying or selling a home, financing, insurance, or even home improvements. Remember, our guarantee stands. We will sell your home or ERA will buy it. That's a seller security plan available only through a Hunt Real Estate ERA agent. I'm in the studio with Bill Tine, and again, we were discussing the costs and regulations associated with new construction.
So I guess to continue where we left off, we talked about the prices of homes. So on national surveys, in 2011, for example, the average price of a new home across the country was $260,800, and in 2016, that number increased to $348,900. Became the average price of a new home.
Wow! Yeah. Can you say that again? From 260,000 roughly to 348,000.
Correct.
That's about a $90,000 increase
over a 5-year period.
Okay.
And the cost of regulation went from 2011, that level was $65,224. And in 2016, that cost increased to $84,671.
Wow. So $20,000 just related to regulation in a 5-year period of time. That's a tremendous number. I imagine some part of the regulations have to do with building codes, and we have a caller on the line who has some questions about building codes. So I'm going to welcome Tony from Clarence. Good morning, Tony. I understand you have a question regarding building codes.
Well, I got a question about regulations. Period. If we really want to have what you're talking about, which is a more free market, then we should get rid of 95%, maybe to 100% of all regulations involving the building industry. After all, don't we want to have a free market that's free of the burden of regulations, which you point out cost $80-some thousand? I mean, if I'm trying to buy a house and I know that $84,000 of the cost is regulations, by the way, I'd like you to prove that.
Well, those are the numbers that Bill Tine was stating are national figures.
Correct.
And they're done by national studies. Tony, I appreciate your call. We're going to talk about building codes now. With regard to the cost of building codes, I understand that just recently new building codes have been implemented in such a way that we have perhaps some additional burdens that are placed on construction companies. relative to getting permitting and getting certificate of occupancies in order to meet the standards. I know you've served on some industry panels and at the state level relative to building codes. Maybe you could share with us a little bit about that, Bill.
Well, I am the industry representative, the building industry representative on the New York State Fire Prevention and Building Codes Council, which is the group that really reviews the codes and approves them. And the purpose of the Building Codes Council is to make sure that the code is really functioning to serve the laws of the state of New York and the individual the things that make New York an individual place, the idiosyncrasies of New York, so that everything functions well in our geographic area.
And I imagine that's a rather involved process. So standards are set at the international?
The International Codes Council is the group that develops the family of codes, energy codes, residential codes, the building codes, mechanical codes, plumbing codes, and the like. And then every 3 years, that code is updated, and it's a process, a continuous process over the three-year period where the codes are evaluated and then are vetted, and then ultimately a new code is released every 3 years. Currently, ICC is at the 2015 code is current, and they're working on code development for the 2018 code cycle. In New York State, we have adopted at the Code Council the 2015 ICC as the base code for the New York State Building Code.
Okay, so to Tony's point, there are a lot of necessary changes that are reviewed by experts, and it includes industry experts in construction and land planning and electrical. I know the firemen are represented well on those councils.
Absolutely.
because public safety is the primary driver for those building codes. So obviously there are a lot of necessary rules and regulations. I think what we're talking about are some of the things that have become overburdensome. We do have another caller who has a question about economic hardship in the suburbs. So I'm going to ask John from Rochester to join us. Good morning, John.
Hi, Susan. Hey, Bill. Bill, a couple quick questions for you. Number one, what, in your experience, what is the percentage of getting a positive outcome in an economic hardship case? My experience has been it's very low, and if you could put a number on that, that would be great. My other comment is suburban sprawl. There seems to be a lot of backing of reducing suburban sprawl. I'll tell you, I take an opposite viewpoint of that. I think the more suburban sprawl we have, the better for the economic vitality of this country. Eisenhower developed the interstate highway system in the 50s to promote suburban sprawl in one sense from a standpoint of free enterprise, the other sense from security. You want to spread out the development in the United States, so individual cities, urban areas won't necessarily be targeted because you've got more people spread out and the risk is going to be less. So I'd like to get your comments on that also.
These aren't light subjects. I think starting off with the interstate highway system, it certainly had an impact on our development patterns, without question. I think you'll find that the primary driver of the construction of that transportation infrastructure was defense-related, an ability to move military equipment quickly across the country to mobilize if necessary, and then the ancillary benefits were the movement of goods and services across the country. And then really what happened was as interchanges were built and exits were built and the interstate system was extended into cities, primarily because of the incentivization of that was construction dollars and the economic driving force of construction, put it into places that maybe even the Eisenhower administration never intended, that impacted land use patterns. And so really what we saw after the GI Bill was put in place and it impacted housing and we saw land use codes promulgated that separated uses from one another. That's where we came up with this concept of segregate use, what's come to be known as segregate use, suburban sprawl, where you have sort of a dendritic pattern of land uses where you have a trunk, if you will, a tree trunk, and then branches that branch out, and along each branch there's a different land use. So you'll see residential use off of one branch, another branch might be schools and community services, another one might be places of employment, another one might be the shopping. That's very different than historic settlement patterns, which you're hearing now referred to as smart growth, which will occur at various densities and scales of development, which is where we're really talking about the concept of how communities are assembled historically in the framework of from rural hamlets to suburban villages to urban neighborhoods and then ultimately urban cores, where uses are mixed together in a fairly fine grain, and where we see in older areas uses transition in the middle of a block. So when you travel down a street in downtown Buffalo on Elmwood Avenue, for example, you see the same thing on the left and the right side of the street. But if you go out to Tonawanda on Sheridan Drive or Amherst on Sheridan Drive, you might see one use on one side of Sheridan and another use on the opposite because the land uses transition in the middle of the street. And in suburban patterns, those uses transition very harshly at a very discrete point, the center of the street, as opposed to going down Route 20A out of East Aurora, where you might see you're in the downtown area of East Aurora. And then as you travel east, at some point you find yourself in Wales, and you don't really realize where that happened because it happened in a fuzzy, diffuse manner. And if you keep going far enough, you'll end up in the village of Warsaw, and you'll wonder where that happened again because it didn't happen at a discrete point and very harshly. So there's a very different pattern associated with each, and how the infrastructure is utilized and the efficiency of it is really what's at play. I agree with you there in the sense of free market conditions. There's certainly a great desire to see more of suburban development, the form that we're used to seeing, that we all grew up with. So my office has people coming in every day looking to build homes in suburban neighborhoods. And we have, with increasing frequency, though, we're having people coming in looking to build houses in urban neighborhoods in the city of Buffalo. So the fundamental issue is the people are diverse, their housing needs are diverse, the kind of communities they want to live in are diverse. And that's the beauty of America. We have places like Clarence that are really suburban. We have places like Colden that might be much more rural, and then we have places like Buffalo, which are, you know, cities, and Village of Williamsville, another place. So, and they're all great places, and there are people who want each, and they, you know, they're there to provide for all of us. So I think it's a good thing.
John, I appreciate that call. I think it's important. It was a very interesting answer that Bill provided. Unfortunately, I think sprawl has been a loaded term, and it started off as a technical term, as you described in your answer, Bill. So, John, I hope that was helpful for you, and thank you for calling in today. I really think it's important for people to recognize that some things are not all they seem. You know, the word sprawl can be perceived as a problem when in fact there was a purpose and a design for it. And as you say, there's a demand for it. People want to live out in the community. So I think it's important for us to take into consideration the balance that's necessary. And today's conversation, I think, is really helpful to help us educate the public about real estate and all the aspects of real estate, land planning, development, costs. The more we know, the better able we are to go ahead and plan. And I think you might want to weigh in on that.
Well, I think one of the things that's important to remember is that when a builder or a developer comes into a community, and it's usually the reverse, it's the developer and then the builder, they don't build what they want. They build what the law is. And so whether that form is what some characterize as suburban sprawl, or whether it's what some would characterize as traditional town development or traditional neighborhood development or smart growth, it's whatever the code is for that community that ordains what's to be built. Builders build what the law is. We pick up a code book, we see what it says on how we're supposed to build it, and that's what we build.
That's a really great point, and I think we just have to be able to build the public into that, the buyers, because they are the important element. We really want to be serving the public in all of our efforts. So I really thank you, Bill, for joining us today at our house. Your insights have been very helpful for us. This is Susan Ballard, and remember, when it comes to real estate, Western York is Hunt Country.